Colonel Upchur, Wheel 5. Could we turn now to the actual conduct of the war? Firstly, the period before the formation of the Gazelle Force, where there was a certain amount of patrolling up and down the border. Could you give your comments on the value of the patrolling?
Well, that was about 1,000 miles along the frontier, and we luckily had those six motor machine gun companies. We in one MMG group had three, and two MMG group had the other three, and we split the frontier between us, and I think Kassler was about in the middle. And of course we had a force in Kassler, holding Kassler at that time. Well, there was precious little behind us, only about three British battalions and one or two other bits and pieces, nothing much else at all. And if the Italians had tried to attack the Soudan at that time, I believe that they would have succeeded, even the Italians would have done. It was a very worrying time for us. We didn't really realize the importance of it all if the Soudan went, because if the Soudan went, all the L of C to the forces in Iran on the Mediterranean course would be incredibly difficult in the variety of ways. And the Red Sea wouldn't have been opened, and that sort of thing, convoys going round around Cape Town that way, and the reinforcement route down the Nile, and also the reinforcement route of aircraft coming from the west coast, all that would have been lost. And therefore we began to suddenly realise the importance of it all. We didn't do anything very dramatic, except we darted in wherever we possibly could. We could go out for a fortnight or more, and we had 300 or 400 miles of petrol, and we had rations for that, and we could go up a long pit and dart in and frighten the Italians.
How did you do this exactly?
We just heard where they were, and we heard that by people coming in and telling us where they were, and approximately the force, approximately the morale, because the Sudanese used to come and tell us. Then we would dart in and shoot them up like mad. We were terrified of losing any of the armoured cars, because General Platt said we would not lose the armoured cars before the real battle started. So there was a great terror that we should lose one of those, that they'd get stuck in the mud. But we never did, thank God. But we shot them up, not all that number of times, with armoured cars. But the Italians, whenever they saw an armoured car, even though they were miles away, they thought they were large tanks and reported them as large tanks. And therefore, I reckon that we did our job of frightening the Italians sufficiently so as not to attack. And therefore, it was very easy for us in a way, although incredibly hard work and very wearing on the nerves, because we never knew quite when they were going to come and attack us, as they did eventually in Kassler. And if they had done then, well, it would have been very awkward for us.
It has been said that the Italians thought that we had a lot more vehicles and men than we actually had. Do you think this is likely?
I'm sure they did. In fact, the intelligence officer reported about that, and we captured those reports that they did, and that was due to our mobility, being able to strike in one place and then strike probably another 120 miles away with the same force, but they thought it was a different force. It was luckily that we knew the country fairly well, and we could move due to our training. We could move fairly quickly in fairly bad going, and therefore we used to shoot them up and retire very quickly. So I don't think there was any more to it than that, but we were very lucky, and we got, afterwards, we got considerable praise for it, which rather surprised us.
Could we turn now to the formation of Gazelle Force? First of all, its composition.
Well, it was commanded by a charming chap who became a lieutenant general called Frank Maservi, and it was when 5th Indian Division arrived, the commanding the general, General Heath, I think in consultation with General Platt, obviously, formed this Gazelle Force, and it was partly British, partly Sudanese, and partly Indian. And the two main forces were Skinner's Horse, which was the recce regiment of the 5th Indian Division, and also one MMG group. And after that, we got with us 4th, 11th, 6th, Surrey and Sussex Yeomanry, and then a lot of Sudanese artillery from Shendi, the 37 Howe troop, who did magnificent work. But the headquarters of the two were formed by Frank Musabi in command, and Ross Kellett, who was the brigade major, and then the rest of them were equally divided between British and Sudanese. It proved very effective and worked, but it was largely due to Frank Musabi's brilliance and Ross Kellett's brilliance that, it, in my view, it did.
Could you give an estimate of the general strategy of the Gazelle force?
They just led in front, and they led as fast as they possibly could. We were held up occasionally, obviously, by mines on the road, and when we couldn't get off the road, and we were held up with road being blocked and so on. But we had to go as quickly as we could. We got off the road every now and again and went on. But Musabi was always up there, and he hardly ever said anything else except, bum on, and on we went. And the main way that we did it was that one MMG group went on for a bit, and then part of Skinner's horse passed through them. We had a company usually going in front, and then a squadron of Skinner's horse. It was a bit wearing after a time, because they were probably... The Italians would probably hold one in four defiles. And after you passed through three, naturally something like Berge, I was telling you about, began to slow down and look round and look where he was going a bit faster. And that was when Frank Musabi went up, and he used to shout, bum on. Well, I think that he had been very carefully looking at his map, and he had a lot of intelligence, which probably we hadn't been given, and he probably knew better than we did where the Italians were likely to be. But at the same time, his actions were very brave, and I remember on one occasion he led the whole lot of us through a defile. But we felt rather ashamed after that.
And in what direction was the main thrust of the campaign?
Well, there were two, really. There was us in the north, and we went from Kassler through Kero, through Agordat, and then on to Cairn, where, of course, we were held up. And then we went on to Asmara, and then from Asmara down to Ambrolaghi. And that was our way of going. And then in the southern route, the 5th Division went to Tessinai, Akoto to Barintu. And then I think they were stopped there because of Cairn, and the whole of the 5th Indian Division were brought back, and their transport used for the... build-up of the attack on Cairn. Masses of shells were required and that sort of thing. But these two raids were about 50 miles apart, and that was the main strategy, as far as I know, of the thing. Actually, I should say that behind us, although Skinner's horse were 5th Indian Division, behind us came the 4th Indian Division, which was fresh from its victories at Sidi Barani. And they, when we got held up, they would attack on our route. And there were, I remember there were the Camerons and an odd Indian Rajputana rifles and that sort of thing. And when we got held up, as we did at Kerala, they were all coming up to support us. On the other route were the 5th Indian Division, the southern route, and they had Slim with them. And when we got held up at Kerou, it looked as though that we were held up by 5 battalions, and it looked very much as though we were going to be held up for a considerable time. And then Slim was suddenly tailed round Aikota, which is about immediately due south of Kerou, to get his forces away. They were still in contact with the enemy, and proceed forthwith with all speed, repeat all speed, up to a track which the 5th MMG company, which was part of two group, knew about, because they had been in Kassler, and they were attacked in Kassler, and they did jolly well there when they attacked, but they had to evacuate, and they were very keen to attack after that. They knew this route, which was behind Kerou, was on the route from Kerou to Agordat. And when Slim was told that he was to go on this route and take the forces in the rear, as soon as he got there, at least he didn't get there, but as soon as they got there, Kerou fell, and they all retired in complete confusion. That, I believe, was the most magnificent strategical effort of the war. Unfortunately, Slim, who was doing rather a Masurvy act and following up five MMG companies as quickly as he could, unfortunately, his vehicle was shot up by enemy aircraft, and unfortunately, he was hit in the bottom, and so he had to be evacuated. Very, and he describes in his book, very largely the same way as all our soldiers were. And Ronald Lewin describes it very vividly. So Slim didn't have all that amount of luck, because he had was responsible for the force that attacked Galabat. And he, in India, had a magnificent brigade which he trained himself. And he brought that over. And unfortunately, one of his battalions was removed from his brigade, and another one replaced it, and that was the battalion that let him down. I won't say what it was and who it was, but that was the one that let him down. And he also had bad luck with his tanks, that they came across rocks which he couldn't have seen, that sort of thing, and a lot of them were destroyed. And then another thing that occurred was that the lorry which carrying all the spares for the tanks was shot up by enemy aircraft. So he had misgivings with regard to that. And then, of course, he was determined to get his end back at going up to Kerou, which, of course, his force did, largely due to his driving and so forth. But, of course, he wasn't there to see it. So although he must have had incredible good luck after that, he had extremely bad luck when he was fighting in the Sudan and Eritrea. Charming man, though, in every way.
Do you have thoughts on any of the other leaders of the war effort?
Well, it'd be rather impertinent for me to say, but I was a tremendous admirer of Wavell. I mean, I met him when he was commanding our division in Aldershot before the war. Chinaman who hardly said anything at all, but had a brilliant brain. I think his trouble was that he had a better brain than Churchill's. But he was a charming man and brilliant. He had very small forces to do all the jobs he did in the Middle East. He never wasted any of them for one moment. And that thing about switching 4th Indian Division from Sidi Barani down to our advance on Kerou was a brilliant strategy, I thought, and what everybody else thought so too. Then he was down at Kerou for the final battle. When he saw that the battle was going to be a success, he ordered General Platt forthwith to return 4th Indian Division up north. Then, when we eventually attacked at Ambrinaghi and won at Ambrinaghi, the first thing that he ordered was that the South African forces should go slap through, and we embarked at Massawa, and we had sent a force down to Massawa to take Massawa, which was taken, I think, on the 8th of April, soon after Asmara was taken, and another force was sent down from Asmara to Massawa, and Massawa was taken. And luckily, the harbour was not completely blocked, and we could use it, which made all the difference to the supply on a very long LFC. And his main requirement after that was the South Africans and 5th Indian Division should move up to the Middle East as quickly as possible. So as far as that was concerned, we had tremendous admiration for Wavell in every way. With regard to Platt, I was very fond of him. He was a fiery little man, but he was kind to me. Occasionally the Indians referred to us as Platt's private army, and I don't think really he did favour us, but occasionally perhaps.
In what sort of way would the favouritism be shown?
Well, I don't know, but you know how it is. People are rather apt, I wouldn't like to say, but there was that sort of feeling at times. But he was brilliant too, in that in his decision to it must have been very awkward for him when Kassler was evacuated. He wanted to attack Kassler and capture a whole lot of people who were in Kassler, the Italians in Kassler. And then suddenly he found in January 41 that they'd all gone. And we were all facing in the wrong way. And we had to up sticks very quickly and go flat out after them. And he got the whip out and he ordered us to go as quickly as we could. When we got to Keren, it was he who ordered the 15th Indian Division to go back and that the whole build-up should take place for the Keren battle, which was obviously not very popular with General Heath, the 15th Indian Division commander, kick his heels back there, but that was the order. And Jerry Stainer was the chap who had to sort of organise all that sort of build-up at Keren. It wasn't easy because there were three battles of Keren and we very nearly failed. And I've told you the problems that went on at Keren. And when I thought of what they ordered and what we ordered together, I thought to myself, well, thank God we had no trade unions there. But
could you describe again some of the problems which you faced at Keren?
Well, the problem was that the Italians were held the mountains, and the mountains were absolutely sheer on either side. And they would put barbed wire just below, about 30 yards below the top. And then they would have one or two people looking over the top, and the remainder would be just under the crest. Well, the trouble was that our artillery couldn't hit them, because we couldn't fire from the flank, especially. And mortars could hit them, but they weren't all that good. And therefore, Peter Gregson's 3-7 Howard troop were very, very much in demand. But the trouble was that we had no mules there. We had no mules there to start with. I think they had later on. And therefore it meant that it took an awful lot of carrying up of food and ammunition. And furthermore, it took an awful lot, perhaps as many as 12 men, to carry chaps down who had been wounded. So it was very much a soldier's battle, which everybody took part in. But what I admired about Pratt was that he never gave up, and I think we had three attempts, and in the final attempt he was down to three tanks and no reserves at all. And I remember he talked about it, and some junior officer said, was that really wise, sir? And he said, no, of course it wasn't, it was against the rule in the book, but it succeeded. But if it had failed, his name would have been mud. So it was a brave act, and I believe he was very good. And it was a pity, really, that he was taken away from the Sudan, which he was in September 42, and he went to East Africa after that. And I never heard, really, but I think his first love was the Sudan, and I don't think he was ever quite as happy there as he was with us. He was very happy with us, and we liked him a lot. But there it was, and it was a pity, in a way, that he left, but he was succeeded by a general who was a brilliant Q staff operator, and of course Khartoum was the centre of all the supplies being sent up to the in the various multitude of routes which went up to the Middle East, and this chap there was responsible for arranging all that. And I don't think they thought Pratt would do it as well as he did. I think they might have been wrong, but in the same time that was the idea. I don't think that I can elaborate any more on that unless you want me to do anything.
Could you go back a little to Keru and the description, particularly of the last known cavalry charge, as a more lightweight relief to the battle?
Well, it was very frightening, actually. It was the only time that I really knew that they really counterattacked. And at Keren, we got there, and we got sort of blasé, and there was very little, not all that amount of enemy aircraft. And we got held up at Keru. And we came from rather sort of broken ground into an open plain. And at the other side, I think the open plain was about 2 to 3 or 4 miles wide and long. And we were held up on the other side of this plain by mountains which were absolutely blocked our passage completely. It looked as though we were going to be held up for quite a long time. And the 4th and 11th, 6th went into action, and our gunners went into action, and so on. And we were sort of sitting there saying, oh, well, I expect we should be able to get on soon enough, and so forth. And then Sunday, from our left flank, we were more or less nose to tail, miles down this road, really naughty, but there we were. And Sunday, on our left flank, about 3 miles of it, I think, there was sort of sounds, peculiar sounds, noises and so on, and then a certain amount of dust. And then there was sound of hoofs going on. And then it suddenly appeared as a cavalry charge. And it was, well, Bobby Popham tells me that it wasn't the Duke of Aosta's special cavalry, but it was something like that. It was commanded by a baron on a white horse. And of course we were taken completely by surprise. And of course, actually, we did, but we didn't mean to do it. We did exactly what we were always told to do, to hold our fire, but it was actually because we couldn't get the flipping guns to work.
Why wouldn't the guns work?
Because we weren't as ready as we should have been. That is the answer. And eventually we got them to work, and the gunners turned round their guns and fired over it and set them on the ground. It was terrible, because there was so much carnage. Especially of the horses, which was terrible to see, and I think we felt more sorry for the horses than we did for the men. But they very nearly succeeded. It was a very, very brave thing to do, and rather typical of sort of what we've always heard the Italians would do. But as far as I never did, they never did it before, they never did it again out there.
Could we turn aside a moment from the general lines of the campaign to considering how casualties were dealt with?
Well, we had this Mobile Field Hospital, which had one British doctor, and I think there was one Sudanese doctor as well. And we had medical orders, which he'd trained, and I think we had two or three ambulances. It was all pretty haphazard. But the trouble was that chaps on patrol were quite often 40 miles away from our group headquarters, and they had to be brought back very often in an open vehicle to group headquarters where they were dealt with by Henry Richards, who was brilliant in his own way. But of course, he hadn't all that amount of stuff there, but he did all he could, and they were patched up as they could. And then, quite likely, they had to go back another 60, 70, 80 miles to the next place. And then again, well, I don't know, I think they were sent back from Gedaref or somewhere like that by rail, back to Khartoum. It all took a long time. We were very lucky that we didn't have all that number of casualties. But of course, at Cairn, we didn't, because we weren't so much in the battle then. But the British and the Indians, they had a lot of casualties. And I'm not quite sure how they did, but presumably they had more facilities for that than we did. But it was a worrying time for us. And I think that Slim would probably, if he was still alive, he would agree.
Did you have to treat Italian casualties at all?
I don't know. I can't remember any. Not as far as I can remember, no. Mm.
How about Italian prisoners of war? If we go further after Cairn to Asmara, which surrendered, of course, there are a large number of Italian prisoners were taken. How were the prisoners dealt with?
Well, when we got there, we were about the first to get there, actually, and we were told, the Italians asked, that we should go to the colonial barracks, because they were terrified that the colonial troops were going to go looting. So we had to go to the colonial barracks and put a guard over the colonial troops. But there were forces organised to sort of come up and deal with the sort of whole of taking over of Asmara, because there were absolutely masses of white Italians, women with masses of babies and all that sort of thing. And I remember that General Platt had to send his private plane back all the way to Khartoum to get tinned milk for the babies, because they hadn't had milk for a long time. I can tell you other stories about that, but I won't.
No, go on.
No, I won't. Not now. Later on. But there were forces to come and look after all that coming up, but we were fairly mobile forces, and we were rather hoping we might have one or two nights in the Asmara to enjoy ourselves, because it's some pretty amusing places, but good restaurants even then. And there was a nightclub. There was even a brothel and all those sort of things, you know, which we thought we might go and have a look at, and go and have a meal and go and inspect and have some fun. But no, we were ordered to go straight down to Eddie Ugri, because there were 150 British prisoners there who had been taken in the British Somaliland campaign, and we were ordered to go there, and of course Bergy, as he always did all those things, moaning a bit that he hadn't got his flipping squeeze box, was sent down there, but he was thrilled at the thought of going to Eddie Ugri to relieve these prisoners. And with great cheering and delight, they disarmed their guards and took over the whole place and put up a Union Jack, which they'd been sort of making privately. And I remember we were the main group headquarters. We went down a little bit later, and of course we had to find that we took with us certain special people who had, or responsibility was for the prisoners, because they knew who the prisoners were. The list had naturally had to be taken straight away so that they could signal back that they were all right. And I remember that I was talking to one officer, and I said, "What's your name?" And he said, "Wilson." I thought, and I said, "Congratulations." So he said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, I'm sure it's you. Isn't it you who has won a Victoria Cross?" And he said, "No, nonsense. Don't talk." And I thought I'd made a most frightful gaffe. And luckily, that one of the chaps who came up agreed that it was Wilson, and seconded what I had said. We were all highly delighted. He still didn't believe it until eventually it became a fisheries rule. It was very sad that after that he joined the long-range desert group, and in the Mazouk battle, before Kufra was taken, he was badly wounded and had a terrible time and was evacuated. I don't think it was any more. But he had obviously done very bravely in the Somaliland, but he didn't believe it for a long time. Very nice chap.
Were you able to see how the British prisoners of war had been dealt with by the Italians?
As far as I know, they were all right, but that's... As far as I know, that we didn't hear really that they were all right, but in the desert, of course, the prisoners taken by the Italians were far worse treated than they were by the Germans. The Germans, Rommel, in my opinion, was absolutely outstanding as a gentleman in every way and a brilliant strategist and tactician, and he admired him absolutely tremendous. And I remember when we were up at Kufra, we thought this chap Rommel was terrific, a great gentleman. He insisted that prisoners should be looked after and treated absolutely properly. But we were lucky. I thought that they were all very, very good, our commanders, and I wouldn't have any... I would say, actually, that Cunningham and Auchinleck in the desert before Montgomery could be criticised. I don't think they were awfully good, in my humble opinion.
In what way?
They were outwitted by Rommel. It was very lucky that we had such tremendous superiority in the desert Air Force at that time. Otherwise, we'd never even been able to get back to Alamein as we did. And I used to hear about it because we were out at Kufra, which is, you know, out in the flank. So I think I'm talking too much.
No, not at all. Returning to Asmara, how there were the prisoners dealt with? Have you referred to the problems of the civilian population? Presumably there were relatively few of you to deal with the enormous numbers of Italians you captured.
I honestly don't know, because we literally went into Asmara and we were ordered to go down absolutely forthwith, because the whole object of the exercise was to get after the Italians before they could get themselves concentrated. So we had none of the joys of Asmara until the end of May, then we did. When Amber Largo was captured. That's another story.
In your opinion, how well were the different units coordinated? And particularly with respect to the different national groupings, how well did, say, Indians and Sudanese and British and so on relate to each other during the whole campaign?
As far as I know, very well. There was no doubt about it that at Cairn was a spirit between them all. There were even Palestinians, Palestinian commander. And we literally, it didn't matter who we were, I mean, we were given an order and we carried out whether we were British Indian or what it was. For instance, we had, I think we were the only force that had machine guns. And therefore, we were ordered to go up and reinforce the troops. And I'm not sure whether they were Indian or whether they were British units, but we reinforced those troops with our machine guns. But it didn't matter. We all sort of linked together, although we had different colour and different faith, but it didn't make any difference at all. We were all out for the same object, to win the war.
I have heard that part of the Italians' perhaps lack of spirit, which has been alleged, was due to their fear that if they picked off white leadership, the colonial forces would go on the rampage and they would be, to quote, put in the pot. Do you think that this reasoning played any important part in the Italians' defeat?
No, I think they were just a window. I think they had no spirit at all. They were just a window. And I think actually that Sidi Barani did a lot to put the fear of God into them. And I think that Kero also horrified them, because they were never quite ready in time after that, except at Kero. And then when Kerem went so quickly, and then Tekla's arm went quickly. I mean, they just hooked back as quickly as they could to Ambrolaghi, and they knew that as the South Africans were coming up the other way, they were finished in any case, and it was just a matter of time before they were. But they did fight occasionally. They fought round Gonda quite well, but I wasn't.
How did your Sudanese troops react under fire?
Very well. On the